This is Jessica Mack. I'm here in Washington, D.C. with Mary Proctor and Halsey Bowen. It is Saturday, June 29th. So I wanted to start by asking if each of you could talk a little bit about what brought you to Princeton in the first place. What was the trajectory that brought you to the roles you took on there?
I was in Brazil in the Foreign Service with the U.S. Information Agency for 3 years, and one of my best friends was Peter Bell, who eventually got the Princeton Prize, or whatever they call it, I forget what it is, as the chairman of CARE. He was a remarkable person who saved several people, important people in Latin America from either losing their jobs or being killed. Mm-hmm. And one of them eventually became the president of Brazil. He was somebody I admired tremendously, and he'd gone to the Woodrow Wilson School.
With Fred.
With Fred, that's right. That's right, I forgot that.
Oh, okay, oh wow.
And so I was talking with Brazilian students about American policy, and by 1967, they were convincing me that being in the Vietnam War was ridiculous, and I thought it was a little hard to work for the Foreign Service defending American policy if I really didn't believe what we were doing. And I was going to be transferred back in any case to the U.S., and so I decided to resign from the Foreign Service, and I became really interested in domestic issues because of all the riots that took place at that time, mm-hmm. killing Martin Luther King right after I got back in 1968. Mm-hmm. And I applied to the Woodrow Wilson School, and to my amazement, having a woman apply that had good boards, good graduate boards, and a career in the current service, they were eager to get me. And they invited me down, and I met all kinds of other people. And then they accepted me quite early, and then in the fall, I came. So then I found myself. They say somewhere there were 150 women graduate students. It seemed a lot smaller to us then. We knew there were only about 20 women undergraduates. It seems surprising that there were as many as 150 women graduate students, but there were four of us in my class at the Woodrow Wilson School, four in the older class, and then one who had graduated all by herself before any of us came.
Okay.
So we were in the dining hall with, you know, hordes of men trying to more policy wonky than the others. You know, this is where the sort of uptight masculinity mm-hmm. was observed. And we sort of took it all in, and then about November, we started comparing notes. This is a really weird place.
Yeah.
And around that time, my parents came down for a Harvard-Princeton game, and I don't know if you've read this story, but I heard the Princeton band do a funny little song that must have been broadcast, it must have been put up on screens, I'm not sure what, about the critters, who were the 20 critical language students.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they ended up doing things like calling them cunning linguists. And all the references were sexual. So I got together with my fellow, at that point probably seven, Woodrow Wilson women, and we said, this is outrageous. But we were so nervous that I wrote a letter to the Daily Princetonian citing it, and that's in this mm-hmm. book, I mean this thing by Alice Armstrong, that I signed it, a female graduate student. And I can still bring back, it brings back some of the emotion of that, the fear of being targeted in and such an overwhelmingly male institution. So, the next thing I know, Neil Rutenstein is calling me up. And this thing says that they spent quite a lot of time trying to figure out who wrote this thing.
Okay.
And somehow they figured out it must have been me. So he calls me into his office. He's in his mid-30s at that point. And I would have been 27, I think. And
how old were you born?
42. So I entered in 60, fall of 68. That doesn't make sense. Yeah.
Yeah,
I would have been 26.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he's a very charming man. And this handsome, charming man in a huge office invites me to come and sit down. And I start saying, yes, I wrote the letter, and I was really, really angry. And he said, here's the letter I've just written to the band. And we got talking about all the things that we women were having trouble with. And then the next thing that happened is I got invited to speak to alumni in the winter about whether Princeton was ready for coeducation. And my thesis was it really wasn't.
Wow.
That it had no idea what women would contribute to Princeton, and it wasn't ready for that. And it wasn't ready for the greater sociability of women, the greater curiosity, all the kinds of things that stir up campuses.
Yeah.
So then I got invited to give several more talks to alumni, and then I got invited to write the article you've probably seen.
The Princeton Alumni Weekly.
Mm-hmm. And then I got invited to give a big talk, I guess on the same subject, or maybe I was on a panel, in the big Woodrow Wilson School auditorium, which you've been in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And at the end of it, this man comes up to me and says, I'm Provost Bill Bowen, and I'd like to see you in my office. And I go, what's this all about? Then I go over to his office. I go over to his office. He, at that point, is only 37. I mean, he was a very young provost. Mm-hmm. And he said, I'd like to have you. He knew the Woodrow Wilson School well because he'd been that.
He wasn't the dean, but he was the director of education or something.
Yeah,
Marvin Bernstein was the dean.
Yeah, but Bill Bowen was, in effect, the number two. And he said, I would like you to take a work study and work for me. And I figured that out that you can work three-quarter time for me and do your degree in 2 years. And I think he'd already arranged it. And I got paid money. I got paid, in effect, with minimum wage, but that for a graduate student was great. And he was a fantastic person to watch in action. He was deeply political, deeply good at shaping events, and 100% for coeducation, because women had already entered at that point.
Right.
So we were trying to do things on the fly, and he said, I've hired two other people, or the university has hired two other people. Mm-hmm. Described you. Mm-hmm. At what point were you hired that year? Because he hired me, in effect, in May.
Well, this sort of segues into answering Jessica's question about my experience.
Why don't you tell your trajectory?
Now we're talking about the 1969-1970 academic year.
This is happening May 1968. 69.
It was May 69.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So as Mary mentioned, Peter Bell, who was our mutual friend, and Fred, my husband, was a graduate student, had been a graduate student in that same Woodrow Wilson graduate school class. And we were then living in New York, and he was working in public television, having left the LBJ White House, where he was on the staff, to work for NET in New York. And the Woodrow Wilson School was having a spring alumni party. So we came down from New York and went to the party, which was in the big dining room, in Woodrow Wilson School. And it was the very Friday in May that the Board of Trustees was meeting to make the decision about
their
education.
I could not believe how late that was. They already had all these candidate applications.
So Fred and I were at the edge of the dining room, and into the dining room strides Bill Bowen, whom Mary's described to as the provost, and Bill is a very intense guy with kind of eyes and...
He's a mixture of...
And he came in...
Appealing and intense, yeah.
He's large. He's always intense. So he came in, and I had known him quite well, because during the years Fred was a graduate student, he engaged me frequently to meet with and tour the wives of male faculty he was trying to recruit.
Oh, healthy.
The Woodrow Wilson School's faculty to take the wives around and, show them the scene and to tell them everything. So he knew me. And we'd been socialized been to his and Mary Ellen's house and, you know, got to know them quite well. So anyway, he walks into this party. Fred and I are standing there having, I think, just arrived. And he said, "Elsie, I've got this terrible problem." And he's like, "There's this terrible, terrible problem. The trustees just decided to accept women in the hall. I need a dean of women. What about you?"
I've never heard this story. That's wonderful.
Oh, my God.
So I said, "Yeah, sure, Bill, sure," and sort of laughed. And then the next day, he called me in New York and said, "I mean it," in his intense way. "Come down tomorrow and interview with Neil Rudenstein and
you didn't know
and Ed Sullivan."
Way.
I'd never met Neil. Yeah. I only knew Bill quite well from years prior to finishing graduate school. So I said, "Okay," and I was married clearly and had three little kids who were then. 2, 4, and 6. Mm-hmm. And so I drove down, and it was deluge of rain, and went to Neil's office. And
were you also charmed by him?
By Neil?
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't have described him the way you did because he's sort of the opposite of Bill. He's much more laid back. And
yeah.
Much more decorous. And
right.
Much quieter personality. So anyway, in the meeting in West College with Bill and Ed Sullivan and Neil, the three guys are wanting me to take this job because they're a little desperate. You know, these women are all coming. What are they going to do? And there are 170. They decided to take women and then subsequently admitted with Carol Thompson working in.
Yeah, they had like 500 applicants.
171 women. 100 of them freshmen, 71 upperclassmen, and several of those have been critical language students who were there in that program,
mm-hmm.
and then some transferred from other places. So they, I said, what do you want me to do? Oh, we don't know. Just what do you do with it? And I said, well, yeah, give me a little more sense of things, and I said, but I've got three little kids. I need some flexibility. I need to have at least a couple afternoons a week off. Fine, no problem. And they gave us a big university house. You know,
I had no idea when I met you.
There was,
and you've been in that house only 4 months.
It was Gardner Patterson's house.
Oh,
and where he was on Fitz
Randolph Road.
Okay.
It was a gorgeous
Fitz
house.
Randolph. It's a big Tudor house on Fitz Randolph. You know the. You probably know the houses on Broadmead and Fitzgerald.
Right, yeah. So very close to the child care center, where it runs the...
Exactly, just around the corner.
Ha!
Oh!
So anyway, so we moved there in short order, you know, sort of within a month and a half. And then our family always went to Maine in August, and I remember... And I was getting a kick out of this because Kim has taken this job, I think I told you about. And she just had a similar negotiation with her new employer. Anyway, I said to Neil, who had then sort of taken the lead from Bill once I said yes and was going forward, but I need to be in Maine for a bit with the family before I start. So I uncovered the other day a sort of desperate letter from Neil saying, "But can you come back for a day to work on whatever it was before?"
Can you imagine? You've got to get all kinds of stuff ready.
And the kids are little, and what am I going to do with the kids? And, and Corky, who was the youngest, I got into Mrs. Cordelieu's farm school, which probably no longer exists. But the second year, she went to UNAM school, my youngest.
That's right. At Carol was telling me that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And my middle child was in kindergarten at Riverside, mm-hmm. and the oldest one was in second grade at Riverside. So I had to go to all the school things at the house.
I really had no idea. When I met Halsey, I met you at your house.
Uh-huh.
And she went and woke up all her kids, and they all had dark hair and dark eyes, and the hair was almost the same color, and there was one bigger and a middle one and a smaller one, but they all kind of looked, they were all taking naps, and they all looked sort of the same to me. And I just thought she seemed serene, and this house was working really well, and I just thought you had been doing this for years at Princeton.
And it was only September.
Yeah.
We met in September.
I think that's when we met.
Early in the fall.
I went to Columbia, I think, that summer.
And another thing about me taking the job was as Mary was saying, this was Vietnam wartime, so it was very tense on campuses, and we had just been living in Manhattan, where the Columbia students had ransacked the office of Grayson Kirk, who was the president of Columbia, and they literally ripped up his family pictures.
Oh my! I didn't
so
that.
For me, this was a frightening image and felt threatening to me as a parent. So I talked to Ben Silverman, who was our pediatrician, and asked the pediatrician in Princeton that we linked up with, should I do this? Actually, we had been in Princeton before when Fred was a graduate student, and he was our pediatrician, so I went back to him and said, am I going to harm my children doing this? He said, no, of course you can do it. No problem, do it. So I had Ben's endorsement, the flexibility that Bill and Neil were going to give me, and still, it was a tense
and
time.
And Fred commuted to New York.
Fred was then working at NET. He was the news director at NET.
National.
And he was going to...
NET was...
The public television station in
yeah,
New York. In New York.
Yeah, NET.
So he... We'd been living in New York, so he had an easy commute. So he agreed to commute to New York from Princeton.
Uh-huh.
And so anyway, we decided to do it. But there are a couple of really sort of funny moments that echo Mary's stories of the kind of sexism. One of them was that since we'd lived there before, and Fred had been a graduate student, I've done all this stuff with Bill, I knew a lot of Princeton faculty. And male faculty whom I had known for years and who treated me as sort of, you know, a kind of
student
wife and administrator's wife, would say to me things like, oh, Elsie, what is your opinion on the Middle East? You know, they suddenly, with this new title,
right.
They suddenly treated me as like I was a totally different entity, like I had a totally different mind than before I had the name on the door, you know, door, the Bigelow on the floor is an old dad that probably you don't recognize, but anyway, Mary and I know.
Yeah.
So that was okay. Really amazing, listening to these guys who were seeing me totally differently because of the appointment.
Absolutely. So there was and a certain amount of respect and sort of status that came with it.
Well, yeah, but it, with this overlay of suddenly if you have the title, you're a different person than
yeah.
you were before.
Yeah.
In the eyes of men
yeah.
who were there.
Right.
Well, for
and
example, in any of the descriptions of me, I was never identified as a former Foreign Service officer.
Hmm.
I was identified as a cute graduate student.
Right.
And that was sort of interesting.
Yeah. I noticed it was noted in the Princeton Alumni Weekly bio of you, something very feminine, sort of crisp and feminine.
Yeah, crisp and feminine.
Right. I thought that was...
And there I was. I was later featured in the Woodrow Wilson. I didn't bring that article, but I was featured in a big Woodrow Wilson catalog in my State Department job mm-hmm. and looking at all the things that I had done. And
So I'm curious about how, when you came into these positions, these are new roles,
yeah.
how were they described? It sounds like there was some sort of ambiguity about what they, you know, what the role would involve. But
from this guy's standpoint, it was... Do whatever these women need.
So you'll be the dean of students for the women students in particular.
Well, the title was assistant dean of student affairs with special responsibility for women students.
Okay.
Now I want to mention one other thing. Bowen described it to me as we would be part of three appointments, and the third was Pat Graham, who was the assistant dean of the faculty, and she was 10 years older than I was anyway, and had worked at Columbia and was savvy about the way universities worked. So she was dealing with recruiting women assistant professors and professors and getting rid of such rules as you can't be a husband and wife in the same department,
right.
nepotism rule, and right. getting rid of requirements that you have to come and live in Princeton. And we met a lot, I did anyway, we met a lot with Pat, and so we formed our own team to work through a lot of these things in a way together. We could try ideas out on her.
Right. I met with Pat in Cambridge a few weeks ago.
Oh, you did?
An amazing conversation. Yes. Yeah. She's still at Harvard, and we met in the library there. But it's interesting, the way that she describes the position is that the position she was in was a one-year position. And partly it worked very well for her because her husband was at the Institute that year.
Mm-hmm.
He was coming to the Institute of Advanced Study. And her children, I think, were a little older. They were 9.
Well, she only had one daughter, I think.
Oh, she was one daughter.
But they were older. She was older.
Come to school in Princeton. But the position itself was sort of more of an administrative internship.
Oh my God, I didn't know that.
It sounds like it didn't come with sort of the title of, I'm not sure, you know, exactly
well,
what the title
was.
Well,
she was referred to as the assistant dean of the faculty. She probably insisted on that,
I think that's right. And in fact, it sounded like she really shaped the agenda of her own agenda, of the agenda of that position very much.
Oh, absolutely.
Because of her feeling that if women students are coming, we need women faculty.
And I guess, as you're hearing, so did I.
Of course.
Yeah, yeah. Neil didn't have any ideas. It was sort of, do whatever you want. I mean, he was a wonderful boss because he literally let me do whatever I wanted.
And I think Dean Lester was the same way with Pat. He was the dean of the faculty, really nice guy. And she probably said to him, unless I can take this seriously, I'm not going to stay.
Yeah.
I don't know, but I would imagine.
Right.
It'd be interesting to ask her. Because he knew what had to be done.
Another thing that was absolutely key for their appointment of me, given the opposition to co-education that they had been facing before this close vote in the board, was they definitely wanted a woman who was... kind of bridge traditional and this kind of job. So the fact that I was married and had kids were big pieces of why they wanted me.
Interesting.
And you were also very comfortable with the scene at Princeton.
I knew
a lot of faculty members.
I interviewed a few other people and they didn't have those particular... And actually, I don't know that they interviewed a few other people. You probably can find more in this, Jessica, than I know for sure. But it was very clear that was... relevant to them.
Did they say so, or are you just...
I'm trying to remember why I'm saying that so confidently. I think it must have been in conversations, subsequent conversations. I don't think they said it explicitly in that triumvirate interview.
How were you treated by wives?
Wives of faculty?
Yeah. Were they nervous with you?
I don't think so. I don't remember that.
Oh, maybe because many of them already knew you.
Yeah, I think so. I don't remember anything negative about that.
Because that in jobs, in the Foreign Service, there were some women who were very traditional and believed in that. Because I was the third year in which women were admitted to the Foreign Service. Mm-hmm. The third year, women were admitted to the Woodrow Wilson School. And then there were a couple after that. Third year that women were admitted to the Office of Management and Budget, and the third year that women had served on the Harvard Board of Overseers.
Really? Wow.
And third year was much better for me than being first year. I like being third year.
Of course.
That brings up another anecdote. I remember being at a big faculty meeting in Nassau Hall at one point, and Bill Bowen saying something about he was having a rough week because his wife was laid up. She'd broken her arm or something, and he wasn't able to do everything.
Like cook,
and I'm thinking,
and then he had relatively young children. Yeah, right.
Wow. And I was the only official female administrator in the university since.
Isn't that amazing?
More ambiguous assistant things. So the whole idea, the oblivion, you reminds me of what's being said about Joe Biden these days, the oblivion to the implications.
Right.
Yeah, I'm having a very hard week because my wife sprained her wrist and she can't do everything.
Oh, poor baby.
And it was just all the guys in the faculty and they were
nodding their heads, of course.
Except for Suzanne Keller. And Nancy Weiss had been hired the same time.
Suzanne Keller was the first.
Nancy
was an assistant professor then.
Yeah, they were neither was married or had kids.
Right.
So there was that difference, that parenting piece.
I think Suzanne Keller, at least by the time I got to know her now, she was the first woman I knew that had kept her maiden name. She was married.
Yeah. Okay. She wasn't married then.
She wasn't married then.
No. At Princeton, she was not married. She had been married in the past, and she did marry subsequently. But in the years we were there, she was not married.
That's a great story.
Let me ask about what, if any, do you think was the role of the Woodrow Wilson School in all of this? Because it strikes me as significant that both of you came out of the Woodrow Wilson School network into the Nassau Hall administration. And do you think that was because of Bill Bowen's connection to
Woodrow
Wilson
School? I would say it's Bill Bowen's personality.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, was there more, was there perhaps
more? Well, he would know. He wanted me to do some analysis and also represent, in effect, him at meetings like the Standing Committee on Curriculum and stuff like that. So he would know that Woodrow Wilson people were activists more than PhD economists. And he would know that they had been trained, well, in your case, you were married to somebody from the Woodrow Wilson School. But I was trained to do analysis.
But also, his personality, he was such a mover and shaker and doer that he, you know, he would keep his eyes out for who he thought
was.
Okay.
I mean, as in me taking around the wives of faculty, male faculty he was trying to recruit, that was, you know, long before Princeton was going co-educational.
Sure. Okay.
So that's just who he was.
That's kind of the community he was in.
Yeah.
Now, I think I particularly was highly amused at the ragtag bunch that the three of us were. Particularly, I have to give Pat credit for having real credentials. That Halsey was just grabbed from her motherhood job, and I was grabbed as a graduate student. And I got a kick out of that. So I didn't have to live up to.
Except they clearly wanted a credential from me. So I had a Smith BA and a Harvard MAT. And I had taught, and I taught in high school, and I taught rookie
programs. Oh, yeah, because you've got a high school real
job. They cared about my CV, even though I didn't have a PhD at that point.
Who she eventually got.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I got it.
Where in my case, because I was a graduate student, and they kept referring to me in these articles, I didn't have to have my Woodrow Wilson degree already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they were compromising on the MRS and the PhD. But then I went on to get my PhD.
Which I was very admiring of. Yeah. Halsey was a role model of what could lie ahead.
So tell me more about that sort of relationship between the three of you. You said the three of you met quite a bit.
Mary and Pat were both in Nassau Hall, and I was in West College.
Okay.
So, and they were more working in Bill's orbit. And I was at Neil's, so we didn't have functional responsibilities all the time. I certainly didn't have functional overlap with Pat, but with Mary, we did, because we got assigned, as you know, Mary got assigned to look into the University Now daycare thing.
And the University Dining Hall.
By Bill, and then...
Because that's in this article.
And then he assigned me to be the administrator, the official administrator in charge of making it happen. So that threw Mary and me together on that project. Mm-hmm. But Mary and I worked on a lot of other things. Like.
But we were already friends. I mean, from my perspective, we were friends.
Oh, yeah. But then we worked on other things. But we became friends by working together.
Yeah.
Space. We did a lot on space planning for the university with John Lafter.
Okay.
And Princeton. We had
at least one failure.
Which one?
Which is to convince I.M. Pei when he built a series of triangular apartments. Do you know? Are they still up?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the apartments.
Yeah. And they were, and to have a laundry room that would have a ping pong table, and
our argument was that these little triangular buildings, you've been in them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There were, I don't know what they are now, but there was nothing but the stairway to go up. There was no communal space, zero communal space. Mm-hmm. So as a dean of students thinking about student life, I was keen on having some ways for people to meet and interact to each other. So Mary and I made the case to Pei, can't you figure out some communal space around mailboxes or something
in these apartments.
And he was...
He was so disdainful. Was and right. Lawrence Rockefeller, I think, was with us when we were trying to he didn't pick it up.
Yeah.
But I had gone, and I think you and I together might have gone, into one living room area and dormitory after another with nothing happening, just empty. And I may have done that more on my own.
I just was reading in this file I just unearthed some proposal I made to Neil about breaking up commons into five dining rooms and assigning students to create more community opportunities among students, as opposed to the the mass of commons were like.
Because they had freshmen and sophomore. All freshmen and sophomores ate in one dining room.
So when they gave me responsibilities for thinking about these things, I was thinking about, you know, how students connect to each other and make friends.
Sure.
And the entries, you know, the first class of women were all assigned to Pine Hall, and it's an entry hall, no common spaces. Mm-hmm. And so I got them to at least put a kitchen in one of the entries, so there was some common space, but was working the whole time there to find ways to have kids connect with each other. And that's another one of the ironies about coeducation, that it turns out that all those efforts, including starting the Resident Advisor Program, which I did, and several others I'll tell you about, the male administrators thought these were all needed for women. But in fact,
they
were needed for students in general.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is they said, since we're having women, we better have a, don't you think we need a dance program? Can you find a dance instructor?
This is a great story.
So I said, okay. So I interviewed dancers from New York, and including from Alvin Ailey Company and others, and eventually hired a woman named Zava Cohen. I don't know if you've heard of her. Anyway, she was terrific. And sure enough, the first day of signing up for dance, 60 students signed up for dance, but 50 of them were men.
What a great story.
Wow. That's wonderful. I love
that.
So
then the dance program went on to be highly co-educational. It was not only women at the time. So there
That's
were loads of examples like that of things that we did. And that also reminds me that in contrast to Yale, and Nancy talks about this, I think, some in her
book. I haven't read the Yale part yet.
Princeton, as we said, took only a handful of women. So with 171 women, I really could get to know all of them more or less. Yale took 600 freshman women that first year. And
freshmen, because Princeton took some transfer students.
And Elga Wasserman had the equivalent of my job there. And at some point during the fall, she asked me to come help because she was drowning in what do I do with, you know, and no infrastructure and no help and so many students and the same sort of entry system situation. So in that sense, I think Princeton and I were much luckier that we started small enough that I could stay on top of every issue and be ready.
And
to
I saw Nancy Weiss what happened after I left, but they went fairly quickly in 4 years, I guess, to equal admissions.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think that was a benefit, that it was more of a gradual process?
Oh, definitely.
It was hard on the women. What have you heard from people in those classes?
Oh, the feedback I get, and Nancy tells in her book that they felt they had me as a resource.
No, I'm just
so
talking about...
they could get a response quickly
to
anything that was bothering them.
So
whereas Elga couldn't respond to 600 women.
No, I meant that... But they felt Princeton was pretty weird, did they not?
Oh, plenty of them, sure.
Yeah.
It was weird, but it could be, you know...
Weird
be
with a...
Nimble, as they say, about organizations.
Right.
And they had you as a resource.
Because I was... I was at the ready and could respond quickly. Mm-hmm. And I had a lot of... parties, I guess, events at our house, this big house on Fitz Randolph, where I'd invite a group of women, a group of faculty over, and male students to get to know each other in small groups. So a lot of this making connections among them, so they supported each other that way too. And creating the RA system, resident advisor system, was no small thing, because then we trained the RAs to look out for each of them for 25.
And how many RAs ended up in the men's dormitories?
They were everywhere. I mean
when you created the system immediately,
they
went to RAs everywhere.
Yeah.
For freshmen.
They had kind of a half-assed version of it before it was there, but this way, every freshman was assigned an RA from then on, men and women, and co-ed groups. So again, so they had,
Oh, really?
Huh.
Yeah. That's great.
It's really sort of...
I didn't know about how, and that's great.
How co-education can reshape the university on so many levels, beyond just the introduction of women students, right?
Yeah.
It just really starts to reshape. But I thought about this a lot reading your Princeton Alumni Weekly article as well, but thinking about kind of intellectual differences and different approaches to knowledge. You have a great line about something like women are less likely to use knowledge as a weapon.
Yeah.
And I love that because I really identify with that so strongly, but even now, having just finished a graduate degree at Princeton.
Yeah.
And I don't think it only falls along gender lines. I mean, I think there are many people who use knowledge as
well,
a weapon.
Yeah, I also talk about somebody that ends up, a man that ends up in a place like Princeton that would have the same cultural problem.
Exactly. And I think that's, it sort of creates an opening, right, for different ways of knowing and different ways of communicating.
Right.
And I think that's something that isn't talked about as much.
Now I want to go back to the dining halls because my second year working for Bill, I was assigned with another Woodrow Wilson School student to do a comprehensive study of the economics of dining halls of different sizes.
Right.
So this is a perfect example of Bill the economist wanting a good solid argument for the Board of Trustees. And I ended up, I think, presenting it to the board, but I at least went to the Board of Trustees meeting that Bill presented it at.
Okay.
I can't remember.
Okay.
It was tremendous fun because I got to visit the University of Massachusetts in Amherst that had gigantic dining halls for thousands and thousands of people. Amherst, which had at the time, I remember, 400 students. It couldn't have been that small, but it was tiny, and they had tiny little dining halls, 60 people attached to the different dormitories. And then I went to Yale, and I went to Smith, which has tiny little houses, and I got the data on what the cost per meal was for each of these ones and laid it out in this report, which has since disappeared. It may be somewhere in my archives.
Oh, I hope it is.
And so that for me was a great job because it combined my policy instincts, which were you want smaller dining halls, with my love of economic analysis.
Right.
And we came out thinking that dining halls of between 200 and 400, and we had some way of finding out how many, we did surveys in some way to find out how many students, other students knew in a dining hall of, say, 100, there was one of 200, one of 100, one of 200, and one of 400 already, and came out that the where the cost curves and the promoting students to get to know each other curves cross was between 200 and 400.
Oh, wow.
Because it actually at 400 costs were very manageable.
Mm-hmm.
200 got a little bit more, and 100 was a lot more.
Okay.
So anyway, that was a good Bill Bowen-ish kind of thing to have.
And so he was interested in having you in the role for your policy and analysis background.
He knew
as well.
From the fact that I'd given all these talks that I did not hide what I thought.
Yeah.
Well, and she could pull together the data.
Exactly.
Yeah. But I also could do data analysis. And that made it justifiable in the eyes of the Woodrow Wilson School that I was learning analysis. I was really learning how to do good analysis and how it was used.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was learning from university politics how you might think about politics in other
contexts.
Yeah.
So you were a graduate student and working in NASA Hall at the same time. Once you graduated from Woodrow Wilson School, did you continue at NASA Hall? Or
no, I went to Washington and worked for the Office of Management and Budget.
I see. So it was 2 years.
It was just 2 years.
There.
And then Halsey, she continued right into the first dean of women. I mean, it's the first dean of students as a woman, Adele Simmons,
mm-hmm.
was a real powerhouse.
Yeah. Am I right that you were the chair of the committee on child care?
There was a reference committee to it, and I may have chaired a committee that came out of NOW.
Okay.
No, Bill asked you to chair a committee.
Did he? Okay.
To figure out
and I
the
think
university
once
having a...
Yeah, I think once again I had to do...
And then now...
I had to do a policy options paper. Mm-hmm. Not quite options, but... Where would the students come from? What the cost of the faculty would be? I think I did all that.
Yeah. So where did that idea come from, the idea that there should be a committee to talk about child care?
It came from two directions.
Mm-hmm.
The National Organization of Women, that's the part I didn't tell you about. But I came to Princeton, as I told you, a pretty strong feminist and found this very, weird culture which also seemed hostile at times. Mm-hmm. So I joined the NOW, which met every month, and got to know the few women there were in Princeton. And Suzanne Keller, the first woman full professor, was very active. And I can't remember if Nancy Weiss was, but...
She was not.
I don't think she was active. I don't remember knowing her really at all.
Suzanne was...
There was a woman who taught English, assistant professor who taught English, who was quite very outspoken and actually wrote articles and books from a feminist point of view, but I don't know who she was. Anyway, we did a lot of talking about issues, and daycare came up, and for me, it made complete sense that that should be an NOW issue. And then that, how that jived with the end you had.
Well, once that conversation began, I was asked to be the official administrator to negotiate and work it out with NOW.
Oh, okay. So that's yeah. We were thrown together again.
Yeah.
So NOW really was the impetus for even thinking about child care accommodations.
No,
there were
the university was interested. And the trouble is that you probably know this history already, that the University League Nursery School was just a three-hour morning program,
right.
And now with more women employees, and the co-education was a factor in raising everyone's consciousness about this, employed women needed more hours of childcare per day than 3 hours.
Every other day.
The University League Nursery School was a cooperative nursery school, so the mothers had to be, had to be working there, volunteering a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. So there was a tension between those kinds of women employed and women not employed, which gets back to Mary's question about did I feel hostility from women mm-hmm. faculty
yeah.
wives who were not working, and I don't remember that.
There was hostility, though, between the parents who sent their kids to, because they ended up being in the same building.
Yeah.
They didn't talk to each other for a year, I remember being told.
You saw those long memo that
yeah, the letter
that I wrote expelling it all, had yeah. all the nitty gritty details
and
of
how the playground,
how they negotiated this many yeah. square feet for each
yeah.
playground and this many. Yeah. Yeah.
It was weird to me that there was so much hostility and quite scary.
Right.
I mean, you know, unsettling.
Yeah.
So that was the first year. Well, let me just go back one second to the committee. So this committee is created, and the idea is that we sort of explore different options. And my understanding, at least from what I've read in the documents, is that there was a need for full-time care
yeah.
that was not yet available.
Right.
Yes.
But also that...
Not even recognized as a need, I guess.
But I'm wondering, it seemed to me that there was also some conversation about sort of the need across the university, so among faculty, but
and
also staff, graduate students, and even students.
And
was that a possibility?
And then administrators. Once I was sorry.
Right. Yeah. So was that really, during these committee conversations, was there a conversation sort of meeting the need of one particular group? Was it about meeting faculty need for full-time childcare?
I don't really know. And there wasn't any groundswell, because there were relatively few women employed full-time except in food services
and
non-professional.
And all the department secretaries who were quite... important.
Department.
But they weren't that very well paid. But
that was a
big
constituency.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They were often faculty wives, so they had enough money from their... They didn't have to earn a huge amount of money. But they would have been a very large mm-hmm. number of them, because
yeah,
every department had one, and the Widow Wilson mm-hmm. School had quite a few, I think.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What about the graduate students? Like, there were 150 women graduate students. Were many of them mothers at that time?
I don't know.
I cannot believe there were 150 of them.
Yeah, I can't either. Were any of your classmates mothers at that point?
No. Mm-hmm. There were male students in my class that were parents.
I don't know any either. Okay. When you were asking about her article, you've seen these two articles.
I don't know if I have.
This one in 72... by me in the university. You know this quarterly
mm-hmm.
university
yeah.
magazine?
Mm-hmm.
The title of my article is Women Get Conflicting Signals
Oh, I didn't know that.
So that was one of the reasons you were...
And then the second one was in 77, and it was helping students think about tomorrow, and it, in a way, takes up some of the same themes. And in that connection, I organized a series of lifestyle colloquium and invited a bunch of basically dual-career couples to come and meet with undergraduates about how they worked out their careers and their work.
And I got
the names of all the people who came and who led the discussion groups, and they were popular and interesting.
And that was in the late 70s.
Well, 72 was...
This one was 76. I don't know if this was the first one, but the years I was there were 69 to 77.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And when I would meet with small groups of the women undergraduates pretty regularly, and one of the great lines from one of them was with this question of how do I do it all? And Suzanne Keller, by the way, would say you can't. You have to choose. She didn't think you could
be a mother and a professor.
And a high flying professional. But a lot of these women wanted to both have children and be professionals. So this one woman said, I don't get it. The marriage isn't a problem because you can get divorced, but children are irrevocable.
Yes, and you nodded your head.
So, that I kept getting that question from a lot of them. Mm-hmm. How can I be a parent and do things professionally? So they really wanted to talk to women who were doing it.
Right. Now, Sotomayor and Kagan are both single, aren't they?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Well, Sotomayor was married, but she's divorced and doesn't have children.
It's funny how the same language also resurfaces and recycles over and over. I mean, it reminds me of the Anne Marie Slaughter article and all the controversy over that. That was maybe 10 years ago, right? Why can't women have it all?
Yeah, and her writing about the anguish of the struggle for her.
Because before that, she didn't believe it. I was part of the Woodrow Wilson Alumni Advisory Committee to... be part of the selection process, and we met with Shirley Tillman, and were delighted when she said she was very open to women as candidates, of course, but also that she wanted women, any candidates, to not be just professors, to be really active.
And for which role?
For the dean of the Woodrow Wilson School. And I was not able to attend the interview with Anne Marie Slaughter, but my fellow members of this. As part of the search committee said, one of them asked her, well, why would you leave a job as assistant dean of Harvard Law School to come here? And she said, because I'm not interested in being a Supreme Court justice, I'm interested in being Secretary of State. Wow. And for someone from my generation, that was just jaw-dropping. And then, this was...
Which one said it?
Anne-Marie Slaughter said... Now, she at that time had small children, and the problems began when she began to have at least one troubled teen. She had two teenage children. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she realized, and she was commuting from Princeton to Washington as the head of the policy planning office of the Secretary of State, which is one of the jobs that could lead to becoming Secretary of State. It would give you credentials.
That's right.
And she was working for female Secretary of State.
Yeah.
Hillary,
Yeah, she was working for Hillary, I guess. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that was sad for me. And I haven't seen her since. I really, really, really liked her. She's running the New America Foundation.
She's no longer at Princeton.
She's in Washington, running the New America Foundation. And I would love to go to one of their... Apparently they have fascinating sessions and go up and say hi. Mm-hmm. But that was heartbreaking for me.
If you go, I'd love to go too. It'd be fascinating.
She is tremendous, and she's an example of 20 years younger than me.
Yeah.
Every decade has a whole new personality in terms of what the women are like, and she was a very confident woman who's, I guess now must be in her late 50s, early 60s. She might be not quite 20 years younger than me, but.
Mm-hmm. So I want to better understand the kind of the relationship between the university and now, and how that changed, and sort of how that came together. Because that's one of the things, that sort of one of the lingering questions we've had is,
We being the
historians who are working on this project, thinking about the history of the Child Care Center, mm-hmm. is how does this link happen between what many would describe as sort of a more conservative university administration and this.
And I have an answer for that. You know, you're pulling it out of the misty, deep depths of time. But I remember tremendous tension that year. And that now was what the university had to go with. It wasn't their favorite sponsor for daycare, because now was viewed as a hostile feminist organization. And I at one point got called a spear-carrying, who's the name of the very charming Jewish sociologist that everybody adored?
Marion
Levy. I heard rumors that I was being called a spear-carrying feminist
by
Marion Levy. So I confronted him into his office, and I said, and I really liked him, and I, you know, he was in that sense a kind of friend, professor. I never took his classes. And I started just trembling, telling him how unfair I thought this was, and had he ever thought about what it would be like to be a woman in this current world, and how all the incredible things that you could not have access to. I never heard any more from him about him after that. It was probably in the winter before graduating in 72. But or maybe 71. I guess I graduated in 71. It was thinking about those emotions reminded me that I was deliberately working with what was considered a subversive organization, NOW. Yeah, and I liked that a lot when we were talking, but it was unnerving when we were doing something really important, and I felt that the tension with the nursery school.
Do you remember this guy, apparently, in the physics department, John Dow?
I don't remember
because
that's the big, long letter.
This long letter from Bill, mm-hmm. responding to him, I think, answers the question you're asking Mary and me with more detail than either of us mm-hmm. knows about this.
Yeah.
And I assume John Dow was implored by some wives, maybe including his own, to write this. Mm-hmm. I doubt, as a father, that he gave a rat's ass about this, but that would be my hunch. But maybe in your research associate, you'll find out more who John Dow was.
And why he did that.
And why he was so alarmed about now, mm-hmm. which he implies he is in his letter. His letter was actually addressed to Goheen, but Bill answered it.
And from Bill's response, it seems like, first of all, there's a timing issue. There's sort of just a convergence of the university
that's
looking for
main
this
theme,
service.
Yes. And now it's all ready to roll, and why not take advantage of it?
Exactly. Yeah. And part of it seemed to me, just they had the teachers, the very high-quality teachers
exactly.
lined up.
They were all ready to roll.
Right.
And then they lost their space in the Unitarian Church.
Right.
In May, so they were up.
It was
up
a boom for yeah. the university, so the resistance, that looking into that resistance from the university, League and Nursery School would be interesting.
Very interesting.
This is where the fact that, now, Halsey, did Bill Bowen grow up in the dormitory at Denison?
You told me that.
I told you.
But I don't know.
I was sure I knew that.
You know, Nancy is doing a biography of Bill.
Yes, and she's told her to interview me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. She really needs to interview me, because his boldness in putting the three of us together, and particularly you and me together, was a quality of him that was interesting. And I think if I'd had more credentials, I might have rattled more cages. I mean, there's that. But he knew that I was feisty.
Yeah.
From hearing me talk. Mm-hmm. And from hearing about me from the Woodrow Wilson School.
Bill's, this letter to reply to John Dow from Bill says, as is true in so many areas of the university life in recent years, many other groups connected with the university have requested new or additional space, in this case including a group interested in early childhood care for children who were not served by the League School. That is, preschool children and families who could not participate in cooperative nursery school because the mothers were working or studying, who needed child care for more than 2.5 hours a day, or who had children below the age of entry, that was another thing, into the League School. So, in the fall of 69, a committee with representatives from the dean of the faculty's office, my office, that was Mary, personnel office, University League Nursery School, faculty wives, food service staff, secretarial staff, and the graduate school sought to determine how great the need was or might be potentially. And after a series of meetings, interviews, and questionnaires, this ad hoc committee on daycare, composed of, and Mary's in that list,
I'm not in that list for some reason. I don't know why.
You come on later.
I was wondering that.
Concluded a need did exist. And so let's see, when does Mary get the chair of this committee?
Yeah, and that's what I couldn't remember doing. I knew I played a big part in it because I remember just working a lot on it.
And what was the research process like for that? I mean, were there a lot of conversations with women who were already at the university?
It looks like they must have surveyed, at least that first part, who needed it.
So, Jessica, are you going to try to contact, apropos of your interest in how this now in university connection happened, are you going to try to find all those people who were on that committee?
Yeah, we would love to. We haven't waded into that yet.
And here's another funny thing, how they name the women in it. Mrs. Glenn Diamond, Mrs. Patricia Graham, Mrs. Lewis Bell, Mrs. Alan Kassoff, Mrs. Olma Wise, Mrs. Mary Maxwell, Mrs. Donna.
Only a few get to keep even their
so a couple of them
first
have
names.
Their husband's name.
Right.
And so
that's right.
Woman's first name.
God.
And Pat Graham, if I'm not mistaken, actually, you also used her maiden name. So it's Pat Albert Graham. Or at least she does now. I don't know if she does
she
at
used
the time.
No, she used her husband's name.
Graham is her husband. Oh, Pat was on that committee, Mary, so I guess you came.
Was she?
She's in that group, in that committee. You know.
Oh, Mrs. Patricia Graham, right.
At approximately the time the committee made its recommendation.
Because I never learned the Alberg. I knew that was her middle name, but I never called her that or referred to her as that.
I see.
So it says, since the it's points where now was, and being ready to roll without his face, and then says, the university asked Mrs. Halsey Bowen, assistant dean of students, if she would see if there was a possibility of merging the two interests in time to open the day nursery in the fall. Then a series of conversations with Mrs. Goheen, Mrs. Marquardt, Mrs. Outcome.
So Mrs. Goheen played a role, huh?
Yeah, Mrs. Maxwell, blah, 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 blah.
So that the fact that you and I knew each other and collaborated a lot, that was very convenient.
Mm-hmm. And then John left. Where is the paragraph about Mary chairing all this?
And Carolyn told me that the first 3 years were really, really hard. That they had a lot of trouble financially. Did she pass that on to you?
Yes, definitely. They were just relying on tuition.
It's interesting because I don't, even though Corky, my little one, youngest one, went, I was not privy to those difficulties, or if I was, I don't remember them.
Here we go. Incidentally, it should be understood that contrary to the impression conveyed by your letter, NOW is not a political organization in the usual sense of the term.
They are
better described as a special interest group regarding one, representing one broad set of views.
He takes that on right away.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But the fear of NOW is really interesting.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Do you remember when you were attending NOW meetings, were things happening in campus spaces, on campus, in the university campus?
Well, did the meetings take place? I have the impression that they did. They weren't in people's houses, I'm pretty sure.
Okay. So that's very interesting. For today, for example, it's almost impossible that a non-university affiliated group could use university facilities. It's very, very rare.
It was mostly university people in it. It wasn't a larger Princeton community.
Okay.
So, and maybe someone like Suzanne Keller made the case for space. But it's the kind of thing that I didn't question at that time.
Right. And there was there was an affiliation with the larger Central New Jersey now chapter.
Did you find that out?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I believe
I didn't know, I didn't follow that, and I don't remember going to any of the bigger meetings.
Okay. Okay.
So there may have been some leaders of the of now that did.
Do you remember what other issues the chapter was working on at that time, or was childcare really primary in those meetings?
Funny, I remember just it was for venting.
That's very important, actually. Venting.
And we must have. And did you ask Pat Graham if she ever got involved with that? I don't remember her getting involved.
She was not involved.
Yeah. Because there would have been strong interest in more women faculty, but I don't specifically remember that.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I was hoping I had a diary. I went looking around. I checked every single one of probably 25 diaries that I have. Couldn't find one from that time.
Actually, I haven't looked back on mine to see, but I will.
So you were at Princeton through the 77.
Yeah.
And then where did you go after that?
Then to Washington.
To Washington.
Yeah. Okay. So my husband took a job at the Johnson Administration.
Okay, that's right.
Yeah. Working for California?
For California, yeah.
So were you working graduate work while you were working at Princeton during those years, or did you come back?
Yes, I did. I did everything up to the dissertation while I was a dean. So I commuted from Princeton to New York.
You had to have very good time management.
I did a lot. Well, I work on the train.
Yeah, that sounds like quite a bit.
Yeah.
It's interesting, both of you were studying in some way while also taking on these roles.
Yeah.
But I imagine those gave you sort of an insight and perspective into the student experience in ways that many administrators might not have that sort of...
I never thought of it that way.
No.
Well, I was in Princeton, so I could see what Princeton was like.
Right.
And I really liked the Woodrow Wilson School, even though the number of women increased over the subsequent years.
Mm-hmm. And I wasn't, commuting student. I wasn't in residence at NYU. Much was. So it was quite a different. And I had kids and a spouse and a job. So it was a little different. I had one sabbatical term, took a ton of courses that term to get a lot of the credits.
But is that the way you did it, huh?
Yeah, one sabbatical term, but in the 8 years I was deaning.
Yeah.
But otherwise was working full time and doing that.
That sounds like a lot.
Yeah, my husband ran for Congress twice in those years.
Wow.
Healthy has a great story.
We were just talking about that the other night because look, can you tell who's in this picture? Actually, the caption will tell you. Can you see it?
Senator Biden.
Yeah, Senator Biden.
Is he the second to them on the left?
He's the one next.
Here he is. Sideburns.
This is Biden, me, and Fred. And Biden and friends. He came and campaigned for Fred. So I spent a day with him in New Jersey campaigning for Fred. And
what did you think of him then?
He's a nice young kid. Younger than me. He was 3. I think I was.
And he went from there to campaigning for senator? Or he campaigned for. Who did he campaign
for? He was already a senator. And that was what year 74?
74.
And he was. I think he was 70. He was 33, and I was 37 or something. So.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
Well, he's still going.
So
I have to tell one housey story about Fred. There was all kinds of campaign literature all over the house, and they had a cat. And one day the cat just peed on. Peed on the campaign literature. Did not pee on anything else. Yeah. I may have remembered it wrong, Halsey. Do you remember that?
I'm glad to be reminded, and I don't remember it specifically, but you're saying you specifically chose
the campaign letter to the PM. Because he was tired of
he was upset.
Red coming and going.
Yeah, being a, you know, political campaigns are absolutely crazy. It's a crazy time. Along with everything else going on in our house.
Yeah.
Crazy.
I can imagine. Wow. Yeah. So what made you decide to send your daughter to UNOW? Was that in the first year?
Well, as you recognized, it was right across the street,
right.
Just around the corner. It was great. Yeah, no, I was thrilled.
But that,
so I was
that
very much in favor of having the school started.
But it didn't start until the fall of 69, right? So the first year of co-education.
The second year, seven.
The first year it wasn't gone yet.
Right, that's when she went to Cordelia's Farm.
Oh, that's right. Trip.
I had to drive her to way out of town. So the second year, to have it right around the corner. I was thrilled.
And did you like the teachers? And
I remember feeling very positive about it, but I asked Corky after we talked to Carolyn, did she remember her time at the now nursery school? She said, nope, sorry, I don't.
How many years she was there?
She was only, let's see, she was born in 66, so she would have been four. Uh-huh. And so probably 2 years, four and five, or maybe five she started kindergarten. Maybe it was only 1 year.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what do you remember about it as a learning environment or the teachers?
My memories are all positive, but I can't tell you any specific vignette that I can picture about anything except that it was wonderfully convenient and she was happy to go and it was fine.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things we're interested in is sort of how the now educational philosophy has changed but also persisted over time and still seems to exist in some form.
So
today,
tell us about that.
The idea, my understanding of it is that there was sort of this idea that the teacher is not as much of an authoritarian figure, but more of what they would call teachers of the learning consultants.
Yeah, I noticed in this
child-centered
support what the kid's interested in doing, don't direct them to
exactly
to do what you think they ought to do.
Much less top-down than the traditional classroom.
Did you see that in literature? I'll see you now.
It's in one of these memos that Carolyn sent to us. Yeah. Maybe in the one I wrote, I don't remember where it was in it.
The idea that the children can take the lead and have some choice as to what activities they want to do and explore, and the teacher supports that process, which I think was very much of the moment. I mean, there were a lot of other
schools
doing it.
It's a little bit Montessori, too, I guess, in part.
It is, which was founded right around.
Do you have kids yourself?
I don't.
But Montessori at least puts out the materials, and the kids are supposed to be able to build the way they want to.
Exactly.
Whatever it was congenial in my experience as a parent, even though I don't have specific memories. Mm-hmm. I can look back and see if I have any pictures over there, but I haven't unearthed any yet.
That would be wonderful.
I hope he has thousands of pictures.
Drowning and downsizing because we're going to be moving and going through the gazillion pictures and files.
Do you have a timing for the move?
January 22nd.
January
22nd of 2020.
Oh, I see. January 22nd. Okay, that is complicated. Wow.
Just say January, the coming January.
The coming January, yeah.
Wow. So, and if you don't remember, that's fine, but I'll just throw some questions. I'm wondering if either of you remember anything about sort of the discussions about now, where, I mean, you see it in the letter, right? But in the behind-the-scenes discussions at Princeton, was there concern about affiliation with this organization? Or it seemed like the sort of part of the consensus was by partnering with this organization to create the Child Care Center, we're not necessarily affiliating ourselves with the organization as a political entity or special interest group.
Now, my memory, jogged by Bill's response to Mr. Dow, is the most I remember about it. I'm sorry I don't have anything more specific, even though I was the delegated person. I don't remember it being negative or hostile or difficult to bring about once this one critique was dealt with.
Okay.
And again, I was personally delighted. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine. And it seems like there really was a need at that time.
Since they got enrolled quickly. Right. They filled up quickly.
Exactly. Yeah. And then, so the 70-71 year was sort of this trial period. Despite some sort of financial issues, it was a success, right? Clearly, because it continued on after that. But my
celebrating 50 years.
They're still there today. But one thing, and Carolyn, I think, knows more about this, but I wonder what happened with the relationship with the University League Nursery School in those first years, because it seemed there was
I'm sorry, you tracked down these women on the...
Yeah, I mean, I remember the first year they didn't talk to each other. They treated each other as enemies.
Okay.
That was maybe overblown. That was just my sense of it, but... Mm-hmm. But you should, actually.
Yeah,
that'll be fun to see what they remember that is beyond what we remember.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now is
engaged you to do this, right?
The nursery school has. So you now.
So it's still got the now name. That seems funny to me.
It does.
And that would have surprised me back then to know that many years later.
It does, because now created all the infrastructure and content of it.
Right.
University basically just gave the space.
Maybe Betty Friedan would
rented the space.
Betty Friedan would be happy.
Yeah. And you know, they're in a new space now, right across the street.
Carolyn told us that, but
Carolyn said a very good playground. Very nice.
Or
three different playgrounds.
Yeah. We gotta take a little pilgrimage back and go look at everything.
You really should. Yeah.
And they tore down the Butler track. You know, with a graduate student housing.
They did.
Where we live.
Yeah, and I had some of my classmates that lived
that
there.
So
was that Mary graduate student housing?
That's where we lived, yeah.
You lived there.
So did they put up more Mary student housing?
Well, when I was there 2 years ago, there was nothing. It was just barren. What's happened?
They built a new complex called Lakeside, which
is Lakeside already existed down by the lake.
Oh. This is a new one that they built when they demolished Butler. So I don't know what the other thing was.
And it's also called Lakeside.
It's called Lakeside. It's
Lakeside was down literally by the lake, further down from the campus, straight down from the campus.
Yeah, just south of the train station, of the New Jersey Transit station.
Somewhere around there.
Yeah. So maybe it's the same tract of land. I don't know.
But it's definitely separate tracks.
Okay.
Quite a distance. You know, like many blocks apart.
Okay. Yeah, the idea was that this replaced Butler, but there's a couple of apartment buildings and then these little townhouses.
Really?
That are set up. But it's
all built and lived in?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Oh,
my gosh. Fitness center, and it's much more expensive than Butler, so it's been...
Yeah, our rent...
That's hard on graduate students.
Our rent was
more money.
Something like $40 a month or something. It was really...
Wow.
Subsidized.
Yeah, but Butler was beloved because it was just such a unique kind of living situation, a great community. So many people had their kids there.
And I had started a newspaper that was published in the Princeton Packet, called the Project Forum, because Butler was called the Project. That was the name of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I had all the various graduate students who lived there writing stories. About and it was published by the Princeton Packet, which is owned by the Wall Street Journal.
Okay. Yeah.
And I got Barney Kilgore, who was the editor, to publish it. So it ran for at least the 2 years that Frederick's a graduate student there.
So that was before you became.
Yeah, that was while Fred was a graduate student. Okay. Then he became a dean. And then we went to Washington, the Johnson administration, and to New York, and then back when Princeton took women.
Mm-hmm.
I can find some copies of that project form somewhere. Mm-hmm. Stories on graduate students.
Yeah, that would be.
Absolutely. Do you remember there being like sort of a community of spouses, the graduate student spouses?
Oh, yeah.
Women on campus who were there.
Yeah, but I wouldn't say it was a very feminist group, but we, mm-hmm. you know, we shared childcare issues and stuff. But I remember doing a lot with Fred's male Woodrow Wilson School classmates. We did, we had a lot of, we entertained a lot, and we did.
Yeah, and that happened in my class too. We knew each other well,
yeah.
And with both the married ones and the single ones, and we often did end up in that.
And Fred was one of the few married ones, so there weren't that many.
Yeah,
wives.
We had a couple, and they entertained quite a bit. Yeah. They would hang out there.
But since the whole project Butler Track was married graduate students, there were a lot of spouses of graduate students in other departments there.
Right. Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. What were other sort of accommodations that were discussed for women students in particular?
Well, they were part of the graduate college. They were allowed to live there.
They were.
But they would have been, and that's where you would be able to find out how many graduate students there were, women graduate students. That's in the Nancy Weiss book, and she seems to have done very careful research. Mm-hmm. So I was surprised that there were a lot of women in the graduate college, it appears, and they were from,
yeah.
And that's probably because I didn't know them, because they were in engineering, they would have been in different scientific, many different subjects.
Different departments, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I don't know if the one. Actually, if you want to Princeton Packet, I guess it can search, I doubt that our column would be in there.
Mm-hmm. So, my colleague Richard had sent me a message saying that there was the spring of 1970, there was the task force, which I guess was this committee on child care.
Mm-hmm.
They sent out a questionnaire to the community about
okay,
child
that's
community.
What it sounds like. Phone doesn't say it exactly that, but they took steps to find out.
Right.
So
yeah.
This is your fellow history.
Yeah, he's also a historian, and he's been working on this project with Carolyn. He recently graduated as well. But, I think, and we've got some of this from the documents, and this conversation has been really interesting as well to this question, because one of the questions we had is sort of like, why this model? If there's a childcare need, or that there are any number of models that could be taken up, and it seems like there's sort of a convergence of timing now with
yeah.
their... and it worked well. And the full-time issue, but also it seemed like there was some concern about needy families and scholarships, that there would be funding available for families who couldn't afford full-time care.
Well, and then in one of those memos, doesn't it say what percentage are non-university,
mm-hmm.
lower income?
That's right. I think it was supposed
to be one-third. Well, it says half of them are university-affiliated, the other half are not.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah. Mm-hmm. This is another question that from my colleague Richard that I wanted to. He says the original proposal from Central New Jersey Now to Princeton explicitly stated the chapter
came from Central New Jersey Now.
And it explicitly stated the chapter's intention to make UNOW economically and racially integrated.
Hmm.
So how did the university, in your memory, how did the university approach the question of economic and racial integration? Was that a conversation?
I don't think it was explicit in my experience, but I would...
I don't remember that as a big issue.
But I would expect Bill would be totally in favor of it, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Because what I had passed on to Halsey, that he was the son of a widowed mother who worked as a dorm... resident. That's
mm-hmm.
what I understood. Now, I was going to ask you, Halsey, did you ever get to know Linda Morse?
Yes, and Ed Morse.
And I wonder where they are, because...
Yeah, I was going to ask you, because you...
Because Linda Morse I knew very well, and she
yeah.
was in Nassau Hall, and she knew Bill very well.
Yeah.
And I knew her from AMS, American Management Systems.
Linda Morse?
Yeah, that's where... So if you can track down Ed Morse, who was on the politics faculty...
Mm-hmm.
And Linda Morse ended up working for American Management Systems and making a huge amount of money because we all got stock options when AMS went public. It went from being about 30 people when I joined it, maybe about 75 people when I left. There were several hundred people, and Linda Morse went back there after Princeton, I believe,
mm-hmm.
something like that.
Okay.
No, actually, all of that happened after I left Princeton. So she would have... She had children, too. So she may have used
Linda. Linda Morse or something?
Yeah. The problem with Linda Morse as a name is it's not that unique a name.
Right.
It's going to be hard to Google her. But. But she was very savvy about the university. And I think she was hired originally to be staff for the Gardner-Patterson Report.
That's Linda was hired originally?
I think so. It was one of, you know, one of the many staff people, but she was kind of the...
And Ed was a graduate student with you?
No. He was already assistant... I think he was already assistant professor.
Oh, he was in the faculty, wasn't
he? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then he did not get tenure, as I remember.
Hmm.
And they came to Washington, right? And you can
and then Linda worked for AMS and stayed for 10 or 12 or more years and made a lot of money. I gave my stock options to Harvard University as something I could do as an overseer. So I never made this huge amount of money. Sort of a weird thing to realize that.
You gave yourself stock options in what?
As an overseer, I was a baby overseer. I was a young overseer. But all overseers were expected to be able to contribute to the university. So I thought, oh, I have these stock options. And at that time, I didn't think they were going to become very valuable.
What were they in?
In American Management Systems. And they went public.
Oh. Yeah,
and they decupled or they multiplied 20 times. I had $10,000 of them. And so I would have ended up with $200,000. I think some of them ended up as millionaires.
You made a big gift to her.
I did. It was very embarrassing when I realized this. Because I went back, I left American Management. I worked there for 7 years, knew Linda there. And then I went back after working for the government and worked there for another 5 years. And that was when I realized I really made a huge mistake.
Well, you're a big... Funder, donor,
Harvard. 200,000 is a drop in the bucket for them.
Wow.
But that might be an interesting person to
connect with. Yeah, I'll look for her. That would be great.
If she was a parent there, she's a very high energy, outspoken person.
Where? So you don't know if they're still in Washington?
No.
So if I'm going to search her, how would you search her? What else would you put in beside Linda Morse to search her?
Information systems. But she would have retired. Well, AMS, you know, AMS helped screw up Obamacare. They were one of the software companies that did not perform.
Oh, no.
No, really?
They had changed names at that point, but all the top people had converted over to, because I think they got into trouble before that with organizations coming after them. No sign of Linda Morse. And what would Ed Morse have been doing? What did he do when he came to Washington? Do you know?
He wasn't an AMS for you.
No, he wasn't.
I don't know. I just think.
And she was not a computer programmer. She was a, like I was, a sort of content. They team up a good skilled information systems coder, et cetera, with someone who was thinking through the quote business side of a system.
Okay.
And she did that.
Mm-hmm. Maybe Ed Morse.
She married Tom. Huh? 1960, that looks about right.
This looks like,
the global head of... That doesn't look like her.
That's 1990. Well, let's look at Edward L. Morse. Yeah, Woodrow Wilson School. He was there, so we got the right one.
Ha! Huh. And where is he now?
It doesn't say anything about his spouse. personally...
Doesn't say where he lives.
Interest in ballet, etc. Married Linda.
No, it sounds like they have a divorce. Two children and five grandkids. That must be them.
Okay, so see if we can find. So he's.
So he's. Why don't you go and see her middle name too? Linda Castle Jones.
K-A-S-L-E.
Or Linda Jones Morse or something. See if that comes up. It's an E-L.
Was it O-E, I think?
No, E-L. None of those look quite right. Try Linda Jones Morse. Or Linda J. Morse. That might. Because it sounds like she's still married to him.
Linda Castle.
The art of Googling.
Linda Castle Morse.
K-A-S-L-E.
Jones. Okay. She probably would have kept Jones, I would guess. Yeah. See what happens. Or try adding the Morris. Because she was Linda Morris when I knew her at Princeton.
She wasn't born in 1915.
Huh. Bummer.
It's interesting. It has all about him, but not about her. Yeah. We'll go back to him and see if we can find more clues about her.
Now, you knew her pretty well, didn't you?
Yeah, but not afterward.
Commodities Research at Citigroup. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, wait a minute, for International Energy? Holy smokes, he did really well.
Isn't that Lehman?
Wow. Yeah. PFC Energy. That may be where he
Council
is.
Council on Foreign Relations for the state.
Wow.
Were they after?
What are their names?
His name was Christian Merck.
No, I didn't.
Her name
know
was
that.
Frieda Merck. Anyway, even back then, in the early 70s, he had a PhD in East Asian Studies from Princeton, and he couldn't find a job then, and he went into banking and became a major banker based in China.
Well, let's look at what we just found out about Ed Morris. He's an incredibly rich man now, I think.
Hmm. Yeah, well, I don't know that Chris... Well, actually, maybe he did make a lot of money.
No, I'm just saying, when you leave academic.
Yeah. But he tried for a long time to get a job as an academic, but the bank wanted him.
Yeah.
Chemical bank or whatever it was, and so he made a career in Asian.
Oh.
In banking in Asia. Oh, okay.
Was there anything else that you wanted to share just about, you know, this time at Princeton or you now, the child care center in particular? I think we covered a lot, but...
Well, one of the things that was interesting to me in Nancy Weiss's book is what an enormous emphasis it gave to Goheen, who was, from my perspective, quite behind the scenes. I met with him a few times. Bill would take me in to see him. What I saw was Bowen's tremendous stake in coeducation. And it does say in Nancy Weiss's book that he did tell Goheen that if it didn't go through, he would be leaving Princeton.
Mm-hmm.
That's all that's mentioned. But he was... he was... Let's see, the first year that I was there, I'm trying to think. He had played a big role in the Gardner-Patterson, in a lot of the detail of the Gardner-Patterson mm-hmm. study.
He... Bill.
Bill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you feel that too?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that Goheen, they made an interesting pair because I think the role of many provosts is to be the one that's out in the university managing things, and the president deals with the big donors and the board of trustees. But he was a tremendous force, and his power of his analytical brain.
Yeah.
Which one, Patterson or Bill?
Oh, Patterson, but I didn't know Patterson at all, really. But,
mm-hmm.
no, but Goheen was a very eloquent man and very charming, and Bowen was a powerhouse of analysis. Mm-hmm. And he actually was very likable in his own weird way.
Bill?
Yeah.
Yeah, I always got a long time with
him. He was never very personal. But he partly because you'd go into his office and you'd have a 15-minute conversation with him, you had to get ready for it, That was my job, my role anyway. And then he'd give you very clear decisions to work with. He's a great person to work with, but no personal stuff to speak of.
You mean about personal life stuff?
Yeah.
Or
he didn't do small talk.
Yeah.
Very efficient.
Hmm. Did you stay in touch with him when you ended up working for Neil?
He didn't work for Neil.
No, when you ended up working
for Neil. Oh, when I worked with Neil.
Or did you stay in touch with Phil?
Yeah, but not after Princeton much. And Fred stayed in touch with him longer than I did, but no. But I had an interesting exchange of notes with Mary Ellen when he was sick, when Bill was sick, and then after he died.
Oh, really? Yeah. Were they nice?
Yeah, very nice.
I should have written her something.
But not in the intervening
years. I didn't know her much.
Oh, one anecdote that's not really related to what you're researching, Jessica, is that my daughter, Kim, a middle daughter, has just become the head of a 150-year-old legendary preschool in New Haven.
Really?
So she's...
And it's a big one, isn't it?
While a day.
Over 100 kids or something.
I don't know what the enrollment is, but she now is doing what Now did in the sense of running a preschool that has a lot of low-income families and Yale families and other well-to-do families, and so trying to do that whole mix. And her kids went there, too. Mm-hmm. But she just became... They don't call it the head of school for some reason. They're calling it an ED, but... Mm-hmm.
An executive director, is what she's called.
But she's got all the usual responsibilities, for staff, faculty, children.
Send her my congratulations.
That's
on that.
Wonderful. Yeah.
It's kind of... just rereading these documents and being involved in all those nitty-gritty parts of, in the weeds parts of getting university now started. So Kim's now in the weeds, getting not starting this nursery school, but taking it forward.
Transforming.
It's kind
of fun. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a certain kind of person that can deal with all the weeds and still keep your eye on the bigger.
Yeah. Kim's very analytical, but can also do the other stuff.
Yeah.
It's kind of cute that she's doing that.
That's wonderful. Yeah, and I mean, just the issue of childcare is so important and so central.
It's one of the things. She's been a consultant for years working in that world and lots of others.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's one of those that you watch all the Democratic candidates are all, hugely, particularly women, usually for childcare.
Yeah.
And then it all gets dismissed in the paper today by, what's the guy's name?
Did he get dismissed? In the book?
In the New York Times.
In the Times?
By a guy who just said the Democrats have just set things up for Trump because they've got all these wild ways of spending money that will come out of, quote, your pocket. You're being the
you're being Wall Street?
Yeah, you're being the very few people in the 1%.
Leadership,
just really, oh, God.
That's unfortunate.
That's weird that it was the Times report. I wonder.
Well, they're probably trying to show that they're open to different opinions. But
well, maybe which one?
Could I ask?
There were.
Do you remember this, there was a day that Now organized called Liberation Day?
Really?
It was in the fall of 1970. I found this article in the Princeton Packet. Let me see if I can.
Was the central net, was it at Princeton itself?
At Princeton.
Really?
August 26, 1970.
Oh, August 26, so it wasn't in the fall.
Yeah, well, it was selected to coincide with the ratification of the 19th Amendment. There were rallies all over the country. And Central New Jersey Now hosted an event at Princeton. There was a picnic on the field. All this happened on the campus.
The chances are pretty good I didn't get back from.
Okay.
I think that was the year I was working in Bogota.
Oh.
or I was working in Washington. I may not have just, all this would have been early because I think we started maybe a week after Labor Day.
Okay. So it was still summer.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, it was they described this rally in McCosh Hall and a march down Nassau Street. And
that sounds great.
I know. We were wondering if any of you were involved, but it sounds like it would have been still not yet.
I see, because the summers were important to... Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the name Kay Castle?
No.
chair of New Jersey Ad Hoc Committee for the
ERA. Funny, I was just not aware of the New Jersey end of it. It was just so very much...
It was very Princeton.
Princeton, yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, those of us that were in Princeton had such a particular set of observations mm-hmm. and feelings that we were sharing.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Central New Jersey would have been a whole big ball game.
Yeah. Very different. But, you know, there was this whole march into the Yankee Doodle tap room that I believe that maybe that was before... That was the year
because
before.
It was all men?
Yeah. And we have some newspaper articles on that. My colleague Richard has been working on
there was it. Also a teacher's college that might have been called Trenton Teacher's College. I can't remember. That where there were some big protests by the women there.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But I don't remember. I didn't know them, and I didn't know. I just remember hearing about it.
Okay. Yeah. What a moment in time. Amazing. So, and it's just so amazing that the three of you were there and had so much. It was such a
I know,
moment.
I have to call it Pat.
Yeah, she would be.
Goodness, what is that child's drawing?
Oh, this is my scrapbook, which I'm trying to finish. You know, this is part of the challenges.
You're trying to put more stuff in it?
No, I'm trying to figure out what to do with them all. Fall of 69, so here we are, 9/8/69, but... The preschool started in fall of 70.
Who's right? That's July. You. Is that you? That beautiful watercolor.
Yeah, that one. Oh.
And then there's a very cute bunny.
Souls of Winds of the Kids, August 70.
Halsey has... How many little notebooks do you have with drawings in them? And there's like 100?
Gazillion.
Wow.
Oh, in the front hall, they're the ones that won the second prize in the city for the
Palisades
Parade. The Historical Society, yeah, the Historical Society.
I saw them, actually, in the...
Oh, in the museum, yeah, when they were there.
No, I saw them in the exhibit. I can't remember why I went to that exhibit.
They were in an exhibit.
So you compiled these scrapbooks over the years?
Yeah, these are scrapbooks.
But then her little... She's a master of making tiny little...
Drawings.
She has just notebooks after notebooks after notebooks, and she captures people and buildings. And I've gone on three painting trips with you, where you're sitting, you're touring through a building, and there's Halsey with her tiny little sketchbook and her little watercolor thing that's around her waist.
Oh, Mary, that's just reminding me. We got to do another painting just for a day.
Wow.
That is
yeah,
great.
And you said...
Where do you want us to sit?
On the couch there.
Okay. Comrade in arms.
Two of the three musketeers. We actually refer to each other as the three musketeers.
Right, I'll take a few. So did you use that, Three Musketeers?
I remember thinking it, and I probably said it to both Halsey and Pat.
Thank you so much. This has been absolutely wonderful.
And this article, I think, mm-hmm. if you're interested in the education stuff, these two,
Lynn and Jolta have moved to Cambridge. They're actually outside Cambridge, and they're looking at a continuing care community like Ingleside.
Oh, okay.
But they still have their New York apartment, but they sold it from Princeton House.
Mm-hmm.
It
would be interesting to get Neil's take on a lot of this.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the whole idea of throwing together a co-ed, role in a few months is just